I like to say that grandmas are the best evangelists in the church and in the world. Because what does grandma do? I love you, baby. And she tells you some stories and she gives you something yummy to eat, right? And as she's doing all that, but she's telling you a story. She's downloading to you ethics and morals and direction.
This is Four People with Bishop Rob Wright.
Welcome to Four People with Bishop Rob Wright. I'm your host, Melissa Rao, and this is a conversation inspired by Bishop Wright's Four Faith weekly devotion sent out every Friday. And this episode, we're celebrating our centennial episode. Friends, we've done, this will be our 100th episode, and we're celebrating over two parts, this part and next part. Today, we're going to be listening to a number of some of our more popular and really provocative guests. And Bishop Wright and I are going to unpack them a little bit for you. And then next week, our friend Winston Arthur, the Reverend Winston Arthur from the Diocese of Atlanta, myself and producer Easton Davis are going to be listening to some of Bishop Wright's more fiery quotes. And so we're really hopeful that you will take a listen and be inspired to share this with your friends, people who need to hear it. So Bishop, before we start, before we listen to our first soundbite, I'm wondering if you can just share a little bit about how you think we've gotten here with Four People.
Yeah, well, happy anniversary. We have to say first and foremost, right? Happy anniversary, 100 episodes, no small thing. How we got here is, you know, what we believe is that when COVID hit and, you know, people sort of stopped reaching out and were, you know, encouraged to stay home and especially away from congregations and, you know, all lots of public spaces. And there was fear everywhere. You know, we said, now's the perfect time to find a way to reach out. And we had always talked about doing a podcast, but it never made its way to the top of our list. We always had lots of other things to get done. But Easton Davis and I really just said, now's the time. Now's the time to reach out to find a way. And neither of us, though we have listened to podcasts personally, neither of us really knew what it meant to sort of establish a podcast and get it done. So this podcast represents, you know, sort of iterative learning. We decided to try. You know, that sort of, we believe that, you know, giving your best is what God wants from us, is to give our very best and to be kind to ourselves as we iterate and learn how to do things. And so, we got the word out and people seemed to like it. And so we're here and we began to invite people to join us to talk about the intersection of leadership and faith. And nobody told us no. They kept saying yes, you know. You know, New York Times best-selling authors, presiding bishops, governors of the state of Georgia, the head of the Supreme Court in Georgia, state senators, they kept saying yes, professors, practitioners, clergy people, lay people. So we built up a little bit of momentum, and we hope that it's become a space for people, you know, as they're driving, walking the dog, whatever they're doing, where they can just overhear a conversation that has at its heart to encourage people to live faithfully and to make a difference in the world.
Well, I mean, it has reached a lot of people. And I'm wondering if our producer, Easton Davis, might have some stats for us to celebrate.
It's kind of weird, y'all. Y'all normally just hear my voice when it says, "Welcome to Four People with Bishop Rob Wright."
Boom.
Oh, that's great. That's perfect. So yeah, I'll start with this. The first episode we dropped, I remember about noon that day, Bishop Wright, we jumped on a quick call. He's like, "So how are we looking on day one?" And I'm like, "I don't know. We got 350 downloads. That sounds okay, I feel like, for our first go at this." And so, you know, here we are 2 years later, and we have over 120,000 downloads.
Holy
moly. And we average 1,100 listens an episode. We've been in 102 countries and over 4,000 cities. And in the last five episodes, which is a really good indicator of what your listenership is, we've had close to 7,000 downloads in 15 countries and 600 cities. So, you know, we're really reaching. You know, and that's also in the comments that we get. I mean, I've been at lunch with Bishop Wright just in Marietta, you know, chopping some stuff up, and a couple came up to us and said, "You're Bishop Wright?" He's, "Why, yes, I am. I listen to your podcast every week." That was the first thing she said.
Yeah.
"I listen to your podcast every week." It's been a path for people, I feel like, especially during these harder times. It's been certainly, even for me, a spiritual practice that I know that every Friday morning I'm going to be in my gym and I'm going to put on Four People and I'm going to have some time to reflect.
We've been surprised. I mean, pleasantly surprised, right? So the Holy Spirit can use a good try, you know? And, you know, on several occasions, out of the blue, people have said, "Oh, I listen. I'm a regular listener." Whether it's, in South Georgia, where I have been, or in other places, or even in other states I have been, people are like, "Oh, you know, I'm listening. Oh, I like this episode. I like when you said this. I used that in a sermon that I wrote." Or
you got a letter from Texas.
I got a letter from Texas.
A handwritten letter
said, this lady said, "Hey, I don't know anything about Episcopal. I don't know anything about diocese. I don't know much about Bishop, but I can tell you, you encouraged me." Mm. "You encouraged me through some difficult days." And that's been amazing to hear that kind of feedback, and to hear people say that they feel like the conversation that you and I are having, Melissa, is earnest, is authentic, is sincere. You know, there's laughter. We don't shy away from hard stuff. So, you know, we're part of what we're celebrating in this 100th is we're thanking God for what has been. And then also sort of thinking about, you know, what do we do for the next 100 episodes? Who do we need to be talking to? Who would be great conversation partners that will be difference-making for listeners?
Mm-hmm. I love that. Well, I know that the 6 guests that we're going to be highlighting today have been difference-makers for me. And so I'm really excited to get started. Easton, could you play us our first clip by Barbara Brown Taylor?
I think it's hugely important for people of faith and church people to resist the temptation to end the cycle of light and dark and just go for the light, and to say, "I'm in the light. I don't ever want to go back in the dark," and having faith about staying in the light. That to me creates its own kind of darkness. So I would love for church to be a place where you come wherever you are in the cycle, seasonally or daily, and you're not made to feel odd because you can't speak or you're in coate or it's just, you know, the shades are down.
Wow. Holy cow. It gave me goosebumps. Like, Bishop, what do you think about that? That people come to church to feel good and aren't given permission to be real.
Yeah, no, I mean, Barbara has done such a good job with this subject. She's talking about something that she calls full solar theology, which is, you know, a happy clappy, everything's okay with me, I'm all good, and I'm walking towards the light, and all is well. And what we know, if we live a little while, is that's not real life. And so what Barbara has done, and this what this comment is all about, is that as she reads her Bible, she sees that God does some of God's best work in the dark. And that, you know, and that we can take our darkness and our dark times and dark places to God, and we can trust that God will work in those places. God is present in those places. We don't have to be afraid of those places. We don't have to be ashamed when we walk into houses of worship that we're not sort of happy clappy and that, you know, there's joy on the tip of our tongue. So, I mean, what she's doing is so important. She's recovering half of the of Christian theology, which is, you know, "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, thou art with me," right? She's reclaiming that. And it has to be said again, because I think that naively sometimes, you know, we're lifting up only one side of life with God. And that's like lifting up only one side of life with, you know, with a spouse or one side of anything. It's just not complete. The complete part is that we have a friend in darkness, and that we can trust that God is at work in darkness. And our dark times are not aberrant. They're part of life.
Yeah, they're real. That's real life. Yeah.
And so if that's real life and we have a real God who works in that, then why be ashamed? And account for it, you know, create space for people.
I love that, creating space. Well, our next guest is Diana Butler Bass, and she had a really, really great, I think, two-part series when you had her on. I just love listening to both, but my favorite clip is the one we're about to listen to.
What if the church reimagined itself as storytelling community? So instead of it being a community that teaches people about the historical Jesus, instead of it being just a community that recites the creeds, it has those things. We have all that in our history. We have all those resources. What if now the primary calling is to enable people to understand the stories of Jesus, the stories of their own lives, and to be able to frame and tell those stories? If you think of some of the best voices in the Episcopal Church, they're incredible storytellers. You know, Barbara Brown Taylor. I mean, what else has she been doing but shaping story and memoir in particular as sort of the central point of Christian identity?
Mm. You know, Bishop, one of the things that I often will say, and it's almost a lament, is that I think so often in church, we're so concerned with what people know about God, and we're not as concerned with how people feel about God. And I don't think it's exclusive, one or the other. I think it's both and. And I really love what she had to say about maybe the vehicle through that head and heart connection is through story.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, it's amazing that we had these two, you know, amazing authors. And through the, you know, miracle of technology, we've been able to bring them now, you know, in this podcast into conversation with one another. And the through line, of course, is our real life stories is what she's just simply pointing us back to. Jesus told stories. There was a man who had two sons. He told stories of, you know, goats and sheep and fig trees that wouldn't bear. He told stories and he connected people in their real life. And I think that's what we've got to do. You know, one of the things we've done in sort of Western modern civilization is that we over intellectualize stuff. Mm-hmm. We've over intellectualized God, and we're embarrassed about the visceral parts of what, you know, what faith is. And faith is, you know, pulling down the God story into my story, pulling down the God story into, you know, how I bring up my children and how I use my money and how I connect with my neighbor and how I use my time. And so, yeah, to tell the story and the stories of when I thought there was no way, I wanted to give up, I was in despair, and somehow, you know, a left turn happened, you know, or my experience of prayer in my real life, have I found it effective? You know, when have I doubted? You know, that makes real life. You know, I like to say that grandmas are the best evangelists in the church and in the world. Because what does grandma do? I love you, baby. And she tells you some stories and she gives you something yummy to eat, right? And as she's doing all that, but she's telling you a story. She's downloading to you ethics and morals and direction, right? And because it comes from this trusted source, right? That story comes from a trusted source. Then we use that story to attach our stories to. And so I love the way that Diana does that. And of course, that's at the center of what Barbara's talking about.
Mm. How can we reclaim that? I feel like, yes, you are, because what she said, the most expert storytellers make the best preachers. And yet, what you just said about grandma, we all need to lean into storytelling and the way we are integrating our faith into the way we're living and then downloading that to our generations beyond us. So what do you think about that, Bishop? How can we lean into that more? Or
well, when I think about that in this thing called the church, I think about one of the first things that's got to happen is that we've got to commit to courage, right? Because my story is not clean and tidy. You know, I can tell you manicured stories with happy endings, but that's not my real life. And so there have been stories of pain and despair. Like I said, there's been stories of joy. There's stories about things I'm still carrying around that are unfinished. There are stories that I have that, you know, I don't know what the answer is going to be, right? And so we've got to find an appropriate way and, you know, and a courageous way to begin to tell our stories. I think that congregations are a great place to sort of begin to increase people's capacity to do that, right? So what if we found a way to do that. When I was a senior minister of a congregation one time, we had a video project where we told stories about our lives in this congregation. And it was amazing to see how these people had, you know, come over this threshold for 30, 40, 50 years. You know, they had buried husbands and buried wives and baptized children and been married and so on and so forth. And these stories about what this place meant to them in their real lives, right? Was just transformative. And we were, you know, wanted to roll out strategic plans and do all of that and develop fancy spreadsheets, and all of that's important. But what really moved the needle on that community being willing to embrace the changes that were up ahead was to go back first and tell the stories about what the place had meant to them. Somehow, when we valued those stories, the people felt valued and more open to moving forward. And a deeper sense of community was built because people shared their stories. When one person was courageous to share their story, then others shared their story. Then it became a thing. Then it became what we did. So,
well, yeah. You know, it might be apropos for our next guest, Sheffield Hale, who we had on to talk about the monuments, you know, national monuments. And, you know, it's interesting. A story is always shared through the lens of the storyteller. And stories aren't always necessarily true.
Truthy.
They're truthy, but they're always told through the lens of bias, right?
Yes.
And so I learned a lot from our next guest, Sheffield Hale. East, you want to play that clip?
One of the things that I say is when they talk about their heritage, I said, well, my definition of heritage is history with all the bad parts left out. It's not the real heritage. It's what you want to remember. Still widely believed that the Civil War was not about slavery. It was about anything but slavery. And that's really the heart of the Lost Cause. I say, well, do you realize that, you know, a majority of Southerners were against secession? And they go, well, what do you mean? No, of course I didn't know that. I said, yeah, well, you have to start with the fact that 40% of Southerners were enslaved. And then you start getting into the definition, what is a Southerner? And a Southerner has been defined as a white person. But 40% of the population of the South were enslaved. And at least another 10% were against secession for all sorts of other reasons. And so you try to reframe it that way. So it's whose heritage and who's being left out of the story. And then you start talking about when these monuments were erected, because they really believe they were erected right after the war. Like in Oakland Cemetery, the obelisk there is erected in 1870, and it's all about death and mourning. But you go to, say, the statue of the state Georgia State Capitol, John B. Gordon, on a horse. That's not about death and mourning. That's about power. And that's erected in 1910.
Wild. I have to say, Bishop, I mean, how does that hit you today?
Oh, my God. So what we have to remember, like people who don't know Sheffield Hale, so Sheffield Hale is a executive director of the Atlanta History Center, right? And so really, literally an organization who for decades have been charged with telling the story of Atlanta and of Georgia and of the South. And so, you know, Sheffield Hale is a member of one of our congregations, and I met him. He's just an altogether cool dude, and I invited him to the podcast. But I knew that he would bring, you know, this kind of nuance and insight to this conversation about storytelling. And at the time that we recorded the podcast with him, you know, all the rage in the news and so on was about moving memorials and monuments to the Confederacy, men of note who happen to have been slaveholders, et cetera. And so Sheffield Hale, with all of his brilliance, ended up helping people all around the country to begin to figure out, it's like, what do we do in Richmond? What do we do with Monument Row? What do we do with all of these statues? You know, when it was an incredibly divisive and still is. A conversation. So I think what he does is he puts his finger right on the button, right? So we're remembering what we want to remember. And we don't want to remember, in that case, we don't want to remember that we actually were secessionists and we lost.
Wait. Who's we?
Yeah, exactly.
Right? Because he points out that 50% of the South was not for the war.
That's right. Right. So some portion of men and women who lived in the South adopted a narrative called the Lost Cause, right, and claimed something called Southern heritage and didn't want to attach, don't want to attach in polite society anyway, that with the horror and the brutality of American chattel slavery. And here's a storyteller, Sheffield Hale, who wants to remind us that, you know, we have a complicated American story, right? And it's more than a soundbite. And that's what I love about him. You know, he gives this nuance and, you know, he helps us understand that while 40% of Southerners were enslaved people, there's another 10% who were against secession for other reasons. And I would argue there's another percentage of poor white folks who were dirt farmers scratching out a living who weren't slaveholders at all. And there was a lot of nuance in those conversations as well. And so, you know, who are we talking about? Right. So again, it goes to the power of story. And here you and I find ourselves in a moment in America right now where, in fact, in Georgia today, the governor banned certain books. And there's a movement across the country right now to ban certain parts of our American history. And we want to keep, as Sheffield is talking about, we want to keep the mythology, right, and bury some of the nuance, which is actually true and makes it a much more nuanced conversation. Same in Barbara. We want to, you know, want to chuck the dark and, you know, and only keep the light. And in Diana, you know, we want to just take the little bit when the fullness of it all is really where life is.
Yep. I love it. Just one more time. Nostalgia, kind of like heritage, is history with all the bad parts.
All the bad parts removed. That's right.
And it's not true. It's not true.
Yeah. Well, wasn't it Stephen Colbert who gave us that word truthy? So there's a truth. There's a, you know, if we don't have the capacity to square our shoulders and face the truth, then we'll settle for truthy, right? And I think that's what's happening in America, that, you know, women are saying no more with the truthy. I think people that were formerly, you know, marginalized are saying no more with truthy. Here we are, bold and, you know, big and bold. And I think that's what's happening. And what feels so scary about it all is that we've erected this glass house of truthy, you know, and then there's people walking around with hammers and, you know, they have decided to not take mythology. And I can sympathize on both sides because for the people for whom the glass house has served, right, they feel like the whole thing is crashing, right? But the lie and the partial truth has served them well, whereas it has diminished others.
Well, let's talk about something that can bring us all together. And our next guest, Gregory Ellison, had something to say about really well-crafted questions.
Regardless of class, background, or educational level, if you ask the right question in a carefully created space, people will talk. And not only will they talk, they will share their most intimate truths in the company of strangers. But you have to ask very carefully scripted questions like, who am I? Why am I here? At Thurman's question, what do I want really? Or how does it feel to be a problem? These kinds of questions hit bedrock, as Parker Palmer would say. And they walk on the surface of the soul.
They walk on the surface of the soul.
Yeah. that is our dear friend, Professor Gregory Ellison, Dr. Gregory Ellison from Candler School of Theology. You know, someone who spends his life trying to increase the fearlessness in people to have dialogue, right? So what I love about that is that... well, I, you know, in my own self, I had an amazing paradigm shift. You know, we grow up thinking, you know, that we ought to have the answers to questions. We got gold stars on our heads when we were kids. We raised our hands with enthusiasm, said, ooh, 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 you know, and or at least I was that kid. You know, I always had my hand up. You know, I got older. I'm really good at playing Jeopardy. You know, it's about, you know, knowing lots of stuff and, you know, having fast retrieval of those facts. And then you get into real life, right? And you realize in the intersections of real life, we don't have all the answers. And especially as someone, you know, who tries to exert leadership, what we realize really fast when you face things like COVID and other unknowns, economic unknowns, uncertainties, you realize that the only way forward is to become a better question maker, right? The MIT Sloan School calls that catalytic questions. Questions that take you right down, as Greg would say, to the bedrock of the soul. And he was quoting Howard Thurman, who developed 8 questions for leadership. And one of those questions is, what do I really want? So it's a sort of a piercing question, because we have to get past our own veneers, right? And get down to, what do I really want? I mean, really. And so, yeah, it's funny that we didn't really build the podcast in this way, but this is sort of the contour of the conversation, that we're talking about story, and story leads to question, and questions, real good questions, right? Not interrogations, but real good, gentle, and catalytic questions can actually lead to transformation, right? And Jesus does this time and time and time again, right? Either in response to questions or as he makes questions, you know? He asked the man, one of my favorite passages, John, the 5th chapter, asked the man laying by pools of water for 38 years, what do you want? Would you be healed? Right? I mean, and these are questions that if we let them really penetrate, they can change direction, they can change marriages, they can change jobs, they can change approaches to life, they can change, you know, despair into joy.
Yeah. You know what they also do is crack open wonder. So if we're more inquisitive and we're more wondering, then we're less judgmental. We're less, you know, about the other person. So, you know, approaching life through the lens of question versus answer, I think might give us the capacity for compassion, you know, more than not, you know, I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think when I think about questions and how probing questions can be, really important questions, that because I know that that's going to take a season for me to really square up to those questions in my own life, I think I would be, having had that experience, I hope that I'm a little bit more patient with other people as I understand that they are trying to square up to important questions in their own lives. Do you see what I mean? And I think I would also say about questions, I think Greg is right. He had a little module he used to hold up in Emory, where people, it wasn't sort of a proper church service, but he would invite people in and they would sit down and there'd be little rules on the table about how we're going to conduct ourselves in terms of how we're going to speak. And there would be questions and a meal. And when a lot of time was over after you had done these modules, it was amazing to me that, you know, very busy people lingered. And they almost wouldn't go home because the questions had gotten something going, an energy and authenticity that people were really enjoying. And there was no homily, there was no sermon, there was no biblical teaching. It was just some really well-crafted questions that got people close to each other and I think close to the truth.
Love it. Well, let's listen to our next clip by Natasha Reed Rice.
God is a mother to the motherless. That's been manifest in my life. I've had, so as I mentioned earlier, mothers, women who have mothered me by choice. My father said to me during the 5 years that I was a single mom, remember, because he taught me this, I'd given my father when I was like in sixth grade, you know, I gave him this beautiful Mother's Day card. I spent all the time making it in class and I came home. I was so proud and I presented it to him and he looked at it and he said, sweetheart, I'll never be your mother, but I will be the best father that I can be. So when I was a single mom for 5 years of 2 boys, I remembered that. And as much as I wanted to be everything to my children, I realized I could never be their father, but I'll be the best mother I could be. And that set me free. So it was really trying to, you kind of make up for, but also at the same time, you've got to not handicap yourself and others to in the process. And that's been something. And I do believe that my prayer life, my time with God has allowed me to see myself in a mirror in ways that I would not have without that.
So Bishop, I don't know about you, but when I listened to Natasha's story, there were so many things that came to my mind and truths that I had that I was able to put my own self in certain circumstances that I have lived. And it was just because of the power of story that Natasha was sharing that I was able to even, you know, come to my own conclusions about my own life that actually had nothing to do with Natasha. And I'm wondering, after your conversation with her, along with the rest of our the clips that we've listened to today, I'm wondering if that hit you in any way, in any new way.
Well, as a general matter, I have to tell you, this podcast over these 99 episodes and now our 100th have been a blessing to me personally, because they've allowed me to chat with people, and they've allowed me to draw near to some people's stories, to see what's really going on in their life, to use some of their to learn some of their wisdom, how it was earned, to learn from them. I mean, you know, I can't tell you the ways in which these conversations have helped to shape me. And I think that's what we do in real Christian fellowship, in real fellowship with one another, is that we're shaping each other, right? I'm sharing my bit of truth with you. You're sharing your bit of truth with me. You know, Natasha Reed Rice is a Harvard-trained lawyer. She was a classmate with Ketanji, soon to be Supreme Court Justice Ketanji Jackson, and just a brilliant woman, a brilliant lawyer, a brilliant woman of faith. And what we found out that we shared together through her candor and fearlessness was that both of us are biracial. So both of us, though African-American, so to speak, have white mothers. And the trauma of that and what it was like growing up being both, and the benefit, the superpowers of all of that, and the perceived liabilities of all that. And so I have really appreciated, you know, her courage. And she, while not being an Episcopalian minister, she nevertheless serves at one of our congregations in Midtown Atlanta, and has brought her perspective to a group of people who are very different from her. And it has been really amazing to watch how they are benefiting from hearing another side of the story. I think this is the way forward. One of the reasons I'm really proud about this podcast is that, you know, to the extent we continue to keep people's stories front and center, some information, yes, but keep the stories moving, I think it will continue to be a benefit to people.
Yeah, I agree, because everybody has a story, and yet, Bishop, it strikes me how many people will listen to other people's stories and then have the gall to not believe them.
Yeah, well, you know.
What the hell, man? I'm just saying. Well, anyway,
yeah.
We don't have to talk about that. I feel like, you know, there's two sides to every story, right? And it's not just this. It's not that there's always the one person's side we're in the truth, but some person is bringing their lived experience into a space and being brave and sharing. And I just hope and pray that we can get better at receiving that.
Yes.
And seeing that is another human's experience.
Yeah, I hope so too. I think that, you know, the cynicism that we bear, we have to interrogate what's that about ourselves. You know, slightly off of that, I can tell you that one of the first times I was invited into the House of Bishops, I was a brand new bishop. And, you know, someone preached a sermon and we were supposed to divide up in groups of three or four and, you know, work through some questions. And I thought to myself, oh, I've sort of been here, done that, you know, got the coffee mug. And, I think when you get into those groups, immediately everybody goes to in their brain, you know, what can I offer that sounds, you know, sort of relevant, but is safe. And at least that's how I was thinking, right? And this one bishop told a story of the broken nature of his relationship with his daughter. And I'm just sitting there with my mouth open. And how she's a young adult and her choice in boyfriend has really caused a major break in the relationship. They used to go out for sushi regularly, and you could just tell there was such love and affection there, but that had been ruptured by not only their relationship, but other factors. And at the end of telling this story, you know, he said, you know, and so I'm asking you to pray for me and to pray for my daughter and our reconciliation. And I never forgot that. And I, you know, immediately because of his vulnerability and his courage, right? I had to immediately think about offering more of myself in that group. And I would have never had that thought because, you know, I've been in those kinds of groups and those kind of icebreaker conversations 1,000 times, right? And, you know, you want to get out of that unscathed and you want to get out of that without making any contribution. But this man changed the temperature of our fellowship with his authenticity. And I still see him. And I ask him about his daughter. You know, and so the essence of Christian fellowship is not just being in a building together with people for an hour and a half. Or, you know, me giving the soup bowl and you giving the soup in a soup line, right? As we feed people who need a meal. But it's something much, much more. It's sharing the texture of your life. And, you know, I hope that's what the podcast is doing, is some information, but the texture of this thing we call the Christian journey. Mine's, Melissa, yours, Easton's, and, you know, whoever happens to join us. But I think that's what we're supposed to be doing with one another because that changes things.
Yeah. Well, let's listen to our last clip. Will Willimon.
I'm afraid we've kind of trained people to expect you come to church to be better adjusted. Why am I at church? Well, I have a lot of pressures in my daily life. I have a lot of stress. I have a lot of anxieties. I come to church to have a sense of peace or, hey, you need to adjust to who you are. Well, generally, people on top, affluent people generally always talk like that. No, you come to church to be maladjusted. You come to church to say, wow, I've never thought about it that way before. A family who had come from Nicaragua about a year ago and came forth and the children were baptized. And the priest said to the woman, would you like to say something? And she said in Spanish, and the priest interpreted, we'd never heard of Episcopalians before we came to America. And people in this church were the only people who wanted us here. And they helped us get a job and they helped us get a car and they helped us. Well, I thought, how wonderful for the church to say, here's our response to the problem of undocumented people or the problem of immigration, baptism. We adopt people. We take responsibility. Well, to me, that's the wonder that is the church in North America in this moment.
Oh, wow. So Bishop, there was clearly two different parts of Will Willimon's episode kind of smooshed together, I think, because both of them had really, really fantastic parts. So let's take the second part first, because that was fire for me. I listened to it. I was like, dang, that was fire. Our response to undocumented people, our response to immigrants, you know, illegal immigration is baptism. That was like mic drop moment for me.
Yeah. If that would have been a basketball event, that would have been a 360 reverse high flying acrobatic slam dunk, right? Few people, in my opinion, show you how crazy it is to live for Jesus as clearly as Will Willimon does. I mean, I think that's what he's saying. He said, you know, most people think if I'm going to be a Christian and that means I'm going to have the full support and affirmation of the society and I'll be a nicer person and somehow the nation will be incrementally better and because, you know, heaven is just like a regular democracy on earth, right? And here's Willimon just running a sledgehammer through that plate glass window saying, you know, if you want to be a Christian and you've got some concerns about, you know, people without papers and immigrants, well, there's enough love in the gospel of Jesus Christ to make them family And we have a normative response to that, and that's called baptism. I love it.
I love it too. And I thought, you know what? I really thought, what an inconvenient truth.
Oh my God. Oh my God. You know, it's Simon of Cyrene's response to, you know, I'll help Jesus carry his cross, right? It's the woman, you know, who brings spices to the tomb and said, well, you know, they killed him, but I'm going to give him dignity in death. You know, it is. So I guess what we might say that, you know, if there's a line through, we could say that, you know, if the God story somehow touches your story in a powerful fashion, then it should send you out to make a difference in somebody else's story. That's what he's saying. He's saying that whole baptism story we tell, and the little kids, the cherubic little kids, you know, that has power, right, to change national policy, right? And on the way to national policy, you and I get to take a stake in that, a role in that. Oh my God. Now, that is why they used to kill Christians. And that is why they assassinate people like Martin Luther King. Because when the love of Christ looms so large in your life that it begins to affect society, and you really realize that the gospel of Jesus Christ doesn't make you adjusted, it makes you maladjusted, then usually the society's response is to marginalize you, fire you, and ultimately kill you, right? Because that response, making undocumented people family, right, is frowned upon by the status quo. Now you're at the intersection of, I love Jesus so much that I'm going to point out to the country that I love where she is astray from the gospel. Now you got a recipe for disaster.
Well, Bishop, it sounds like you're talking about politics.
Well, I am, because the gospel is political, but the gospel is not partisan, right?
That's right.
So politics means about people. And so when Jesus is talking about people, he's talking about politics. He just doesn't have a party in mind. Yeah. But I love...
I hope you picked up on my sarcasm.
Of course.
There. I'm not
of
really
course.
About it.
Of course, but you know, for anybody who's still struggling at that intersection where they somehow want to divide the universe or the country into sort of, you know, so neat baskets. You know, we've talked about this before, that our first and foremost, our citizenship is in heaven. Right? And so that's what drives us to live out our earthly citizenship. It's not my earthly citizenship that drives my heavenly citizenship. So, and St. Paul was very clear about that in Philippians. And so this is what Willimon is talking about. He's talking about, you know, in Christ, there is no east and west, you know, no north and south, you know, he's talking about no slave, no free, you know, no male, no female. He's talking about this radical notion of me belonging to you and you belonging to me and God making us siblings.
Amen. Well, gosh, Bishop, this has been an incredible conversation, and I'm kind of sorry that it's over, but we know that we're back every week, right? We have more and more of these conversations, and yet I'm curious, what would you have us do? What would you have our listeners do because of the way they're leading their lives because of this podcast?
Yeah, well, I hope that in some ways it's a great support to people who are endeavoring to try to live at the intersection of faith and leadership. Whether we're talking about family or work or congregational leadership or business leadership, whatever it is, we hope that this is a great support to you, a seasoning on your Christian life already, or on your faith life already. And so what we hope is that if this is working for you, share it. If this is good news for you, share it. Why wouldn't you share good news? And I understand that, you know, sometimes we're a little coy about sharing, but I'm asking you to share it. We don't charge for this. You know, there's no sort of sales pitch here, but we just believe that people who have been positively impacted by something, sharing something makes all the difference in the world. And so we'll continue to do hard work and good work on this end. And we're asking you to join us, be a partner with us in this work by commending this good work. And if you're the praying type, we ask you to pray for us, pray for myself and for Melissa and for Easton, as we try to do the work of God for the people of God.
Amen. Well, Bishop, thank you as always. And listeners, we thank you for listening to Four People. You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Bishop Rob Wright. Please subscribe, leave a review, share this with others. And we look forward to being with you next week.
Happy 100.
Woohoo!